This What's Working with Cam Marston podcast is brought to you courtesy of Michelob Ultra Beer.
They say consistency is the key to success. They weren't wrong. So how about grabbing a beer that's consistently smooth, consistently refreshing, and consistently light? You might just find that the road to success can be pretty enjoyable. Michelob Ultra, the perfect balance of taste and refreshment, and only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. Enjoy responsibly. Anheuser-Busch Michelob Ultra Light Beer, St. Louis, Missouri.
Welcome, everyone, to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is the show designed to bring you insight into the workplace, the workforce, and the marketplace trends that are shaping the workplace, the workforce, and the marketplace around us. I try to find guests that can talk about the business issues that will help you and me. Once we've listened to these guests and understood their expertise, they will help you and me get a little bit better at whatever it is that we do. Throughout the history of the show, one of the more popular conversations that we've had have always been around succession planning. And I don't know whether our neck of the woods here in the state of Alabama has more family-owned businesses than other places, has more closely held businesses than other places. But for whatever reason, succession planning tends to be one of the shows that people find most interest in. I get more comments on those. I have people walk up to me and say, boy, I really enjoyed the content around succession planning. I was at a conference not long ago down in South Florida, a place where I don't fit in, by the way, Cam Marston in South Florida. I can never walk through South Florida and look like I'm from that part of the country. There are places across this country where I can change my attire and my outlook and things like that, and people might think I know a little bit about the area, with the notable exception of South Florida. I don't know what it is. I need more necklaces, I think, maybe. Anyway, maybe that's a show. I was at a conference not long ago in South Florida, and one of the speakers at the conference was Scott Hunsaker, and he will be the guest on today's show. When we come back from break, I'll have him on the phone. Scott tells the story of a remarkable way in which he, through the ownership of his company, the leadership of his company, was able to successfully transition out and leave the company better than when he had assumed the reins from his father. So he was second generation and took it over and made it into something different. And most importantly, for the purpose of this show, transitioned the business to a group of employees. He did not use an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program. We have had guests on this show who are big advocates of ESOPs. Scott did not use that as a transition tool. It was his preference. It was his team's preference to not go that route. And perhaps we can get him to talk a little bit about why. But it's the processes that he implemented that made the succession, the transition, as successful as it is. And again, here we are, succession planning. I look for these guests based on the popularity of this topic. And Scott, as a presenter at this conference, was one of the guys that I immediately approached afterwards and said, hey, I want to put you on the show. It turns out Scott does have some customers, some clients in the Birmingham area, as he tells me. He and I discussed that on site down in South Florida, which gives him some credibility in this neck of the woods. So when we come back from break, it'll be Scott Hunsaker with me. We'll be talking about succession planning and how he went about it. And maybe there's some ideas here that you can learn from. So again, when we come back from break, prior to break, updates on what's going on around here. And it's with red face that I continue to talk about the book that's supposed to be here. I am holding in my hand the final, edit one of the final cover design. And there are a couple things that need to be changed, some spacing here and there. But the book called What Works, the book is called What Works, the 10 Best Ideas from the First 200 Episodes, is We take the best ideas, exactly what the title says, which is a good title. We take the best ideas from the first 200 episodes and organize them into this book. Now, let me be clear. It's not the 10 best episodes. It's the 10 best ideas. So chapter one is on perseverance. And here are three guests that spoke clearly of their perseverance and how they did it. That book is now getting closer, closer and closer to final. And hopefully can begin offering downloadable chapters to my listeners here soon. Please hang in there with me. If you're tired of hearing me talk about it, you're the second person that's tired of hearing me talk about it, with me being at the top of the list. Before we go to break, though, let's talk about 529s and college planning. A college education allows your loved one the opportunity to get ahead in a quickly changing world. And though the rising cost of tuition, books, and campus living expenses can seem overwhelming, a 529 plan can make funding higher education an achievable goal. Call Sandifer Wealth Management and talk to them about the ages of your children, your hopes for their college aspirations, and how a 529 plan can help you. Introduce yourself to Jamie Sandifer or Mark Salyers. The 529 plan, as I've said on this show numerous times, is perhaps one of the best decisions my wife and I have ever made to get our kids a firm foothold in their college education. One of the best gifts that we decided a long ago we can give to our children is no college debt. And we might be able to do it. Assuming the stock market doesn't collapse any further, we might be able to do it. When we come back from break, Scott Hunsaker, Managing Partner, Ardent Group. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. The Alabama Center for Real Estate, better known as ACRE, housed at the University of Alabama's Culver House College of Business, is committed to industry engagement and dedicated to shaping the future of real estate through excellence in teaching, research, and service to drive economic and workforce development in Alabama. ACRE and Alabama, a championship collaboration. Learn more at www.acre.culverhouse.ua.edu. We are back. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. On the line with me is Ardent Group's Scott Hunsaker. I met Scott several weeks ago at an event down in Florida, and the content he delivered this audience about an intentional process of succession planning had them in the grip. He had good content, and this audience was ready to hear it, as the audience was people mostly over 50 years old who were thinking, what am I going to do with this business? When I heard his presentation, I approached him immediately and said, hey, I need you on this show. Scott, welcome to What's Working. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So here's something that I want you to know. Of all the shows that we do, the one that usually gets the most attention is about succession planning, because I don't know whether Alabama has a preponderance of these, but so many businesses around here are small and seemingly family owned. And the first generation, maybe the second generation, is wondering how to begin this transition. I know you've lived through it. You began with Councilman Hunsaker, and I want you to tell him about that. But let's begin first with Ardent Group and how Ardent Group was born out of Councilman Hunsaker.
So it was 2012, and my principals and partners came to me, and they said, Scott, we're ready if you are. And what they meant by that is they were real ready to carry on the legacy of the firm if I was ready to share it. Now, this has always been a part of my plan, because when I joined my father in 19, well, I joined the firm in 89, I purchased the firm from my father in 99. And what I saw in my father's firm was, is it really didn't have any value without him, because he touched everything. So when I took over the firm, for me, it was more about creating an organization that could continue on after me and wasn't dependent upon one person. So in 2012, I sold my company to my employees for cash. It wasn't an ESOP, it was a transition. And that's an important part of the story, because how do you teach your leadership team to have the financial resources and relationships to be able to make that happen as well? So when I sold my company, my plan was actually to find another company and do it again, because kind of the niche I had fallen into is how do you transfer that institutional knowledge and business savvy from one generation of leaders to the next? But I've actually led 8 companies. But what happened was, is you mentioned Councilman Hunsaker. We were an engineering firm specializing in aquatics. We designed swimming pools. We didn't do residential work. We did mostly large commercial university work. For example, down in your neck of the woods, we did the University of Alabama, Birmingham. We did the Tuscaloosa Student Recreation Center, those pools there. We also did the Olympics in Atlanta. We worked on the Olympics in London. So those kinds of things. And during my tenure, I grew that organization from 10 people to 50, from one office to 5 offices, and we were doing work internationally, as I mentioned. So while my plan was to go buy another company, when I called my architect friends and told them what I had done, the phone kind of went quiet. And they said, Scott, I'm 10 years older than you, and I haven't even started. How do I do it? By the way, I sold my company when I was 49 years old. And so I started helping out some of my friends. And about a year later, I had 8 or 9 clients, and they were referring me to people. And so I was like, I guess maybe I'm doing a startup here instead of buying another company. So that's how Arden Group got started. And I work with CEOs about how do you transfer the institutional knowledge and business savvy to the leadership team so they have the confidence in themselves where they're willing to push all their chips in. What I mean by chips, yes, it's money, but it's also time. Each of your employees are choosing to spend time in your organization, and they need a return on that investment as well. So how do you give them the confidence in themselves to be able to carry on that organization into the future? So that's what I do today, sort of. Cam, you know a little bit about me. We spoke at an event where a recreation is a part of that. And today I'm be turning 59 next month. And my wife and I live full time on a boat. And I'm speaking to you right now from Norfolk Waterside Marina. And we're on our way up the East Coast, and we'll be going down the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes this summer. So we're looking forward to it. And I appreciate you working around our schedule.
Yeah, I'm glad to get you on the show. It's fun to you've allowed me to follow you guys on Facebook, and it looks like you're having a dream life. People talk about, man, I'd love to sell my business and buy a boat, and very few ever do it. Not only did you do it, you bought the boat and you live on the boat. You made that your new home. It's pretty cool, frankly. It really is pretty cool. Let me step back into the business that you stepped into that your father was the leader of at the time. And it sounds like, you didn't use this word, but it sounds like a personality-driven business. Was it?
My father was an only child. His mother died when he was 14. His father died when he was 5. So I believe that my father kind of is one of those self-made kind of men, or people, you might say. And he was very dependent upon himself. And I think it had to do a lot with losing his parents at a young age. And so for those of you that have family businesses and maybe grew up under your father's tutelage, my father had that 1950s management style. You know, the way he would teach is literally throw you in the deep end of the water to see if you could swim.
Yeah.
So he also had the tendency of he had to do everything. In other words, if you want it done right, you have to do it yourself.
Right.
And that's great, but it's a limiting factor on your ability to grow the organization. And so one of the questions I ask a lot of our clients is, you know, are you a limiting factor to growing the business and achieving what it's able to achieve? Because every time we step in front of one of our team members, not only are we not using our time effectively, but we're robbing from their ability to grow in their role so they have the capacity to do it the next time.
It's a wonderful sounding ideal to want to give your team members the freedom and the responsibility to develop and grow. But it's got to be very scary for someone like your father or someone like some of my listeners who are family driven business, personality driven business. If you want it done right, you got to do it yourself. When you're coaching these people, What is, I imagine you can hear it in their voice when you say, hey, you got to start turning some of this responsibility over to people. And they respond by going, I don't know. They seem to, my suspicion is they want the outcome that you've achieved with this, your sale of Councilman Hunsaker, but they're very afraid of the process. Is that the case?
You know, it's a journey. And it's a journey for successful people. So I would submit that the reason that we are successful business people is because we're really, really, really good at our job. We know the ins and outs of it. We grew it from the infancy, and there's not much we haven't seen. The difference between being a proprietorship and being an organization is instead of doing the job well, it's doing the right thing. And what I mean by that, it would be a lot easier for you to just fix it because you know the answer. But maybe the right thing is teaching one of your cohorts in the organization about how to address this issue. In other words, walk them through the decision-making process. Instead of me saying, here's the answer, go do it. Say, okay, what's the issue? What's the ideal outcome? What's all the information we know? What's all the information we don't know? What don't we don't know? What are the unintended consequences and what's your ideal outcome? So the little nugget that I share with my clients is every time you're ready to give an answer, try and stop yourself and turn that answer into a series of questions, because that's a way to actually develop future leaders in the organization so they can make timely and accurate decisions on behalf of you, so you don't have to do everything, to give you the time, A, to either do more in your business, or B, do some things that you might enjoy outside of the business.
I would suspect when you begin teaching your clients how to ask these questions versus doing it themselves, your clients begin, I would suspect that one of their rejections to your idea might be, Scott, I can do it myself and have it done in an hour. If I teach them how to do it, it might be a day, a week, a month long process. That time and completion of the task and the project is one of their first oppositions. Am I right?
I would say yes, but maybe the way to overcome that is to define what the definition of success is. Is the definition of success, you know, my dad always said confusing the urgent with the important. Is the urgent is solving today's issues. The important is building a team that has the capacity to lead the organization without you. So the point I'm trying to make is if you keep your in front of mind that our goal here is tomorrow, a year from now, 2 years from now, not about the next hour or two. Sometimes it helps. You know, you talked about mentoring and coaching. You know, a lot of my mentoring and coaching is remember what we said we were going to do? Now do it. You know, it's so easy to fall back into those old habits, and I get it. But that is robbing from the future to pay for the present.
Yeah.
So it's about redefining the definition of success, because most of us that started a company, our definition of success was surviving one more day.
Right.
You know, it was just about making payroll and all those things. Now we're shifting from doing it right to doing the right thing.
When we come back from break, Scott, I want to talk about some of the specific steps you can offer people on things that they can do. I know your coaching and your consulting work has a lot to do with building these steps and making them a part of the company culture. But something you can recommend to the listeners who are in this situation of, hey, try this or something like that. We'll give them some tactics when we come back. Scott Hunsaker is the president of Ardent Group. He's actually the managing partner and has been in that situation since 2013. We're speaking to him on his boat in Norfolk, Virginia, on his way up the Eastern Seaboard. He sold his share in the entire business of Councilman Hunsaker in December 2012 and has started a new business of teaching succession planning. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. We will be right back. This is Cam Marston in the studio with Cajun Mike. Cajun Mike, what's going on at E3 Pest Control? What you guys doing today that's different?
Well, what we're doing different is we are treating homes that have spray foam insulation, and we're able to give them a full bond, whereas other companies are not able to.
How does the treatment work with the spray foam?
Basically, we spray the spray foam with BoreCare. BoreCare absorbs into the spray foam. It prevents termites from landing on it and creating an above-ground carton.
Is there any restrictions or limits to how you can do this, or is it any home with spray foam?
Basically, any home with spray foam.
How do they find you, Cajun Mike?
Find me at 251-850-7378 or e3pest.com.
That's e3pest.com. We're back. You're listening to What's Working. I'm on the phone with Scott Hunsaker. He is on his boat in Norfolk, Virginia. He bought this boat and assumed this lifestyle after selling his company that was begun by his father, called Councilman Hunsaker. They designed swimming pools, not like your backyard pool, but pools in commercial settings. University of Alabama in our neck of the woods, UAB as well, the Olympics in Atlanta. Scott is now teaching people how to manage succession planning in their own closely held businesses. Prior to the break, Scott, we were going to talk about some tactics. There are people listening saying, hey, sounds good. Give me step one. So let's now get into some tactics. Do you have 2, 3, 5 tactics that you can offer?
Sure. Let's talk about the end first. So think about it's time to make that transition to the next leadership team. So you sit down with one of your team members that's been with you through thick and thin, been in the trenches, and you sit down and you go, Bob, you're my guy. You're the future of this organization. I'd like to talk to you about becoming an owner. And Bob sits real straight up in his chair and he goes, well, thanks, Scott. I really appreciate that vote of confidence. That means an awful lot to me. He goes, but Scott, I got a problem. And I go, what's that, Bob? He goes, you know, I'm only about 5 years younger than you, and I'm thinking about buying a boat myself. Oops.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have a succession plan that isn't written and isn't communicated, do you just have a great idea, or do you have a succession plan? The other takeaway from this little nugget is very often I see owners looking for somebody in their own peer group. We need to be thinking 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years behind us, because it's going to take them that much time to pay us off so we have a liquidity event and return, get a return on their investment. Or maybe you do something else. Maybe you go and visit your lawyer and you go, you know, let me tell you about Bob. He's the future of this organization. Can you put together a plan so he can become an owner here? And the lawyer puts together a great set of documents. You sit down with Bob and you go, Bob, listen, I went and talked to my lawyer about you becoming an owner, and here's the plan. And Bob starts flipping through it and he sees personal guarantees and spousal waivers and preemptive rights and estimated taxes and bank guaranteeing the bank debt. And all of a sudden, Bob's not feeling the love. He sees the value, how you came up with us. And now Bob's feeling like he's being taken advantage of. And Bob might have the attitude, because I see this happen from time to time, where not only does Bob not feel he wants to be an owner, he doesn't feel he can trust me anymore and he may leave the organization. Have you ever seen the heir apparent in one of your other friends' companies not be there 6 months later? What do you think happened? I would submit what happened is we took them out of their comfort zone and we put them into their sheer terror zone. And then it's just an issue of fight or flight. So how do we avoid that? So instead of starting with the succession plan or the legalese, let's start with teaching them how to lead the company. Because if they have the confidence in themselves to be able to lead the company, then the succession piece isn't so scary. Right. Think of it this way. I've seen CEOs come to the people two different ways. They go, here it is. I've spent my entire life building this company and it is perfect. Now, don't change a thing and don't screw it up.
Yeah. And make your payments.
Right. Or here it is. And it's the best I could make it. And I trust you to make it even better. What do you think has a higher likelihood of success?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do we get them to that point? So we talked about 5 steps. The first 4 are really about teaching them how to run the organization and lead the organization successfully. Step 1 is, how are they getting the information to make timely and accurate decisions? You know, I call that authentic conversations. A lot of us hold our cards very close to our chest. How are they going to be able to make decisions without the information, right? I suspect each of your listeners have a really good gut about what's going to happen in their company next year. I don't know how to transfer gut. So how are we teaching them how to make those decisions? Some common tools might be corporate dashboard, not just the financial performance, but the leading indicators. What are the things that you look at in your business to make an educated decision about what's going to happen tomorrow? What's your most valuable asset? My company was my people. How are you teaching your leadership team to actively listen to the most important asset so we're able to attract the best of the best in the industry, not just today, but 10 years from now? Because our jobs as leaders is to prepare the company for the future. How about our customers? What's going on in our customers, not only today, but in the future? How are we going to react to meet those needs that are on the horizon? So how are we teaching our leadership team to actively listen to those? Those are some examples of authentic conversations and teaching our leadership team about how to have the information necessary to make those decisions. Second step is our leadership team. Now, I don't know about you, but even on the best day with all the tools we have in business about hiring, I was effective at getting the right person in the right seat on the bus about 70% of the time. If we're only effective at hiring the right person 70% of the time, what makes us think we're going to be any better at picking the next leader? And if we pick the next leader and we're wrong, what's that do to the value of our business? What's that do to our leadership team? So I would submit, instead of picking the next leader, what if we created a leadership team bench, a candidate group, and then use some type of business tool to evaluate who is the natural leader? In other words, who has the will or the people, who has the will and ability to lead? So you'd let the natural leader emerge. Because if we pick the next leader, it's often that the other candidates feel that they're being left out or are taken advantage of. The advantage of having them work it out together is that they're creating the strong working relationships that's going to be critical for the success going forward.
You know, I want to stop you there at the end of step two, because this reminds me of a conversation I had on an airplane recently, as well as a thing that I witnessed many years ago when I was doing some work for GE. And that is, well, let's take the GE example. When Jack Welch, and this is the story that was delivered to me. I don't know if this is true, but it's a good hypothetical for this conversation. When Jack Welch was determined that he would retire, and he selected Jeff Immelt to follow him, and I was doing some consulting work for GE at the time, Jack Welch knew that he had four candidates, if I remember this correctly, who could and wanted his job. When he selected Immelt, he had to do something with the other three. And what he ended up doing was finding them, if I remember this correctly, jobs elsewhere. I think one went to Boeing, one went to Home Depot, because since they weren't going to be the big cheese, they weren't going to work there anymore. Do you have any comments on something like that? Of course, on a much smaller scale.
I was about to say, I'm not sure I can translate to GE, but I'll give it a shot.
What if you've got a pool of candidates who want to be the next big cheese, and you know that if they're not selected, they're going to polish their resume up and be gone?
You know, let's bring it back to our size companies. To me, the definition of success is not losing three quarters of my leadership team when I make a transition. To me, that while I respect and what Mr. Welch did is taking care of his people, and that worked for him, that doesn't work for me in our size businesses, because those other three people are critical to the success of the organization. They may not be the leader, but they may own the brand of the company, and they may bleed the company blood and represent the company and be out there. So what I'm suggesting is, how do we create a culture of leadership where we create an all for one, one for all, where the leadership team is dependent upon each other, not mutually exclusive from each other. Mm-hmm. So my point of going through this leadership journey is, if you work through the natural leadership process, my hope, and more often than not, it works out, is that the candidates really see the benefits in each other and see the strengths and weaknesses each other, and actually mold into an organizational structure that is the most effective at delivering the customer experience and the goals of the organization. So I'm working with it. I was just on the phone yesterday with a client where we had one individual that just owned the brand, owned the deliverable, owned what they did. They were just, you know, they were the institutional knowledge, the walk-in Wikipedia of the organization. Now, the other candidate was the operations person. They're the ones that love all the organizational structure. And so, you know, we talked about roles and responsibilities in that, where we kind of created a win-win, where both are integral to the success of the organization, and it's not one or the other.
I see.
It doesn't always work. But if we can give the opportunity to the candidates to see the strengths of the team versus of the individual, what a tremendous opportunity that is to create a bench strength that is able to endure COVID and able to endure all kinds of things.
And I would guess that has a lot to do with finding the right people and putting them in the right place versus it has something to do with the selection process of who you bring into the organization and who you give positions of leadership, to recognize an ego that may become a problem at time of succession.
Correct. You know, I'm going to push back on you just a little because, Cam, you said put them in the place. You know, we in our culture, we have this feeling of top down, we know best. And I get it. And sometimes when you're a turnaround situation, you have to grab the reins and make it happen. But if we have the luxury of time, what a gift it would be to let people find their own place and their own journey and let them work it out themselves. So when we end up making the announcement of this position and those types of things, it's kind of a foregone conclusion because everybody's, well, yeah, they're already kind of doing it.
Right.
In other words, not an anointing. It's a recognizing of what's already transpired and where the strengths are.
And you pointed it out, as you said, that with the luxury of time, and if there's anybody.
We don't always have it. And so I recognize that. So what I'm trying to suggest is if we can plan around the optimum and react to when we have to, the exceptions. And, you know, you were talking about boating and today, you know, we have a plan. We called an audible today because we got 4 and 5 foot seas out there. We're not going anywhere. So we have a plan, but we're always adapting and adjusting to our current environment.
Scott Hunsaker is the managing partner of Ardent Group. He is today sitting in Norfolk, Virginia on his boat. He consults with organizations on succession planning, a very relevant topic considering the aging baby boom population and the transitions that will be taking place. When we come back from break, Scott, let's hit topics or numbers 3, 4, and 5 of things that these different companies can do. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. The Alabama Center for Real Estate, known as ACRE, strives every day to be a valued resource that supports and promotes Alabama's real estate industry and promotes economic and workforce development across the great state of Alabama. ACRE and Alabama, a championship collaboration. Get to know ACRE and learn more about their offerings and their events at their website, www.acre.culverhouse.ua.edu. Customer service never goes out of style. In fact, I think it's safe to say that customer service is more valuable and more important now more than ever. Hi, this is Cam Marston. One thing that my over 200 episodes of What's Working has taught me is how important customer service is to building and maintaining a thriving business. It's the growing need for customer service that's led me to partner with one of the state's leading customer service trainers to create our program called Delivering 5-Star Customer Service. Your team will get one 90-minute training session per month for 6 consecutive months. Each session builds on the skills learned the previous month, allowing your customer-facing teams to practice before moving on to the next lesson. And the 6 lessons address everything from appearance to electronic communications to conflict resolution to maintaining a service mindset. Our program travels and is delivered in person at your workplace, nothing virtual. You simply can't practice the level of the skills this course teaches virtually. For more information, email me, cam@cammarston.com, and let's schedule a time to talk. Remember, you have less to fear from outside competition than you do from discourtesy and bad service from inside your own company. Again, email me, cam@cammarston.com, and let's talk about your business. Scott. Scott Hunsaker is managing partner of Arden Group. He's sitting on his boat in Norfolk, Virginia. The lifestyle he planned when he sold the company that he was involved with called Councilman Hunsaker. He today works with organizations on helping them with their own succession planning. Just prior to the break, we had gotten numbers 1 and 2 on pieces of advice Scott could give any business. We're going to get in 3, 4, and 5. But before we begin, I'm Cam Marston. This is What's Working, brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate. Scott, we talked to number 1, share information amongst the leaders, share ample information, quality information. Number 2, create a leadership bench, people that are being developed and being groomed for more and more responsibility. That leaves us to where we left off. Number 3. Go ahead, my man.
Where do we store most of our business information? If we're being honest with ourselves, I suspect most of us are pointing to the side of our head. Where's the worst place to store business information? I would submit in our head. Because how are we going to get all that information out of our heads into the organization so other people can use it? So in today's world, we have, you know, all types of processes and procedures. We can use Lean or Six Sigma and those types of things. But the real issue here is, how are you getting that information out of your head into your organization? Let me give you 3 quick examples. First is what you do. You know, in our organization, we had specs and policy or specs and details and drawings and things like that. And still, instead of having 3 different people do it 3 different ways, we came up with the best practice approach about this is how we're going to do it. We came together instead of it having to be Bob's job or Bob's project. It was a Councilman Hunsaker project. So when somebody in the field looked at our work, it wasn't, oh, Bob did that or Joe did that or Ken did that. It was, no, Councilman Hunsaker did that because it stood on its own that way. The second is, many of us have continuing education or learning programs where we maybe have somebody come into our organization to present information. Where's all that information being kept? In other words, if you weren't there, do you have the ability to get it? We actually recorded a lot of that, much like you're doing now, Cam. In other words, this is going to be around for a while. So we did an audio recording. We kept all those files and we put it on in our intranet. So it was a year from now when a brand new employee wanted to come in and hear about the XYZ heat pump, instead of me taking an hour of my time and explaining it to them, I had them go out to the intranet. If you have any questions, come see me and we'll talk about it and go from there. And the last, this comes back to those owners pieces. You know, I suspect as a CEO and an owner of your organization that you lose sleep at night. I think insomnia comes a part of the job on that one. And I would submit that those things that keep us awake at night probably are things that we should be sharing with our leadership team so they don't have to learn that same lesson. So how are you communicating those life lessons to that next leadership team? All right, so that's step 3. How do we get that information out of our head into our organizations? Now, all that information comes with a born-on date. In other words, it's gonna work for a while until it doesn't. I would submit that if you don't show up in your business tomorrow, everything's gonna run fine. You got a great team of people, you got it going, and it's gonna work great the next day, the next day, the next day, the next day, until what? Until something changes. So how are you teaching your leadership team how to manage change? So let's talk a little bit about that. How can we do it? Well, we can either talk about going through a process to do that. Let's think of it this way. If one of your team members comes to you and you say, you know, Scott, I have this great idea. And you go, you know, that's the best idea I've ever heard in my life. We need to do that. And 90 days later, nothing happens. Mm. And they come to you again. They said, I have this great idea. And you go, no, that's the best idea. We need to do that. 90 days later, nothing happens. What do you think the likelihood of them bringing us a third great idea is?
So the obligation is action. You got to, and supporting the energy and the.
Well, that's one way to do it.
Yeah.
Then you take the monkey. Now you're responsible and you're the bottleneck. What if we created a process that allowed change to happen without us? In our situation, we put together something called a situation report, which not only it wasn't a suggestion box, they just didn't outline what the issue was. You remember when we talked about the leadership team? What's all the information you know you don't know? What are the unintended consequences? What's the ideal outcome? That was a part of the opportunity to submit it. And then we reviewed those every month. And then we would ask ourselves, do we have enough information to make a knowledgeable decision? And a lot of times the answer was no. So we put together a group of people. They come back, research it, bring it back with an updated recommendation. And then we say, do we have enough information to make an eligible decision? If the answer was yes, we'd affect the change. Now, let me point something out. I don't think you can have a system solution process if you don't have the systems and procedures, the institutional knowledge, because if not, you're just having a lot of circular conversations. In other words, you're not, what are you changing? Are you just talking about it? So you need to have the toolbox to be able to constantly improve and sharpen the saw to make it a reality. Now, we did over about 4,000 system improvement processes during my tenure. The first couple of years, I would submit I was doing about 60 to 70% of them. Who owned the institutional knowledge of the firm at that point in time?
Sure, sure.
The last year or two, I didn't do any. So that's how we transfer that institutional knowledge and business savvy to the team.
So let me, I'm going to push back a little bit here on your comments and think there's somebody out there listening who is a sales driven organization. This sounds like absolutely, this is fine wine for an engineering organization. They love this. This is the MO of an engineer is to develop and internalize and create more knowledge, create more documents. But there's somebody out there that's a gunslinger who is a salesman by heart, and he's listening to this thinking, this sounds just extraordinarily painful, nearly to the point of navel gazing, of let's create another performance improvement document. And he or she wants to go out there and get in front of the customer and sell. What's the, you know, what is your reaction to that?
Let me take it twofold. First of all, do you think a forklift driver can impact accounts receivable? Do you think they can impact on-time shipments? Do you think they can impact warranty claims?
Well, is it unquestionably?
Absolutely. So my point is, how many times has that forklift driver said, you know, nobody ever listens to me. If we did it this way, or this way, we could be so much better. But, you know, the boss doesn't care.
Yeah.
My point is, let's pay people to think, not just do merely what they're being told.
Interesting.
Now, let me tackle your issue about the superstar. Are we going to organize our organizations around the superstar? Are we going to create this? Are we going to hire people to support the organization? You know, I've seen superstars out there and they're great, but I don't want my company dependent upon the superstar. I want my superstar to be dependent upon the company.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I understand that there are those things that you're all about themselves. And when you have a sales organization, it's about me, and they may be a 1099 employee and those types of things. And if that's your culture and that's what turns your crank, go for it. But what I'm talking about is, how do we build an organization as opposed to a group of individuals doing their own thing?
So, point well made. Additionally, I'm going to counter my own comment here, argue with myself. It's often that I find these organizations with these cowboys, with these sales-driven people, these individuals have too much influence, and the organizations actually become more functional once they're gone because of
I would argue, are they toxic?
Yes, exactly.
Because sometimes these people that feel like they are the cat's meow are all about themselves, and they often leave a path of destruction behind them. Not always, but to me, that's not what I'm about. I'm focused on the company, not about one individual rock star. If that rock star works, fantastic. But if they don't fit, I'd rather put the company, I'd rather be, you know, I'd rather not have them and go at it that way.
So number one, share information. Number two, develop a leadership bench. Number three, this was my current terms. This is not what you said, but develop repeatable best practices, document them. Number four, manage change. We're running out of time. I'm going to give you a little bit to hit number five.
You know, now we're ready, because the leadership team has the confidence and the wherewithal to be able to lead the organization into the future. Now we can sit down and have a conversation about succession planning. The value isn't scary because we know how we got there. We understand how all the professional services work, our lawyers and our accountants to support the company, because you've been a part of it. You understand the institutional knowledge. You understand how to make change. Now we can have a knowledgeable conversation about what it means to be an owner. And instead of sitting saying having the lawyer bring documents, I would submit we go through together and define what the expectations of the ownership is, and then bring that to our legal team to put a company-specific succession plan in place that values and recognizes our values and goals and objectives and is in alignment with us. And then it's not so scary.
Yeah.
Then we don't have that sheer terror zone where people are either going on blind faith or not willing to go forward. In other words, now we're in our comfort zone because we have the knowledge and are willing to push all our chips in on the future of the company. Here it is.
I love it.
It's the best I can make it, and I trust you to make it even better.
You're That's bringing the there. Plan to the attorney versus right. you and the attorney bringing the plan to the employee.
Because if you do it that way, whose plan is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Whose do you want it to be?
Yeah. Best case scenario, Scott, somebody picks up the phone right now and calls and says, hey, I've heard this. I'm on in. I am within 10 years of retirement or whatever it may be, 5 years, 3 years of retirement. How long does it take to execute these items that you've listed here?
If you're starting from scratch, I would say a 3 to 5 year time frame is a pretty good guesstimate. It took me 12 the first time I did it at my firm. Today we can do it in 3 to 5. You may be further down the path, yeah. But it's highly unlikely you can do it in a quarter or two.
Yeah.
And so that's a threat to your success if that's what you're thinking.
We're running right up against time, and it's been fascinating. As I've said, Scott, some of our most popular shows have been around succession planning, people not knowing what to do. And one of the things we haven't talked about here is the point of view of the successor. We've talked about the person leaving the company, but we haven't talked about the attitude and the point of view of the person who may be taking it over. And I know that's an element of coaching in the marketplace is let me work with the heir apparent to work with their attitude and what they need to know. And they want the leadership, but they don't know what they don't know. And there are coaches out there that help them. Do you do that type of work as well? As when you meet with your clients, is it with the successor as well?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that sound is obviously a valuable part of your offerings. Again, Scott, very helpful. How can people find you?
You mentioned earlier that I wrote a book, and that's available. And you can also get it on my website. It's called Heroic Ownership. My website is Ardent Group, ArdentGroup.com. If anybody would like to do a deep dive on this, I would also be happy to make myself available on the phone. My phone number is 314-283-1589.
ArdentGroup.com. 314-283-1589. Folks, if you stick around, I'll mention it again in segment 5 when we come back from break, so you can write it down, scramble for a pencil. Scott, thank you so much for your time. Do I say good sailing? Is that the appropriate thing to say?
Sure, we'll take it.
Good sailing. I wish you the best of luck, and I'm enjoying following you on Facebook and your travels. It looks like a wonderful lifestyle.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
You've earned it. I appreciate it. Scott Hunsaker, Managing Partner, Ardent Group, today in Norfolk. Tomorrow, who knows where, headed north. We'll be back after this break. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. Sitting with Cajun Mike, owner E3 Termite and Pest Control. Cajun Mike, there are people I know that think their house is fully protected because there's some bait stations around the house. What's your thoughts?
My thought personally is bait stations do work. However, I do not believe in them as a standalone product.
What else do they need?
We do 3, 4, sometimes 5 or 6 treatments on a house. We will do a true liquid perimeter treatment. We do hollow void treatments, and we use bore care on wood when we can access it.
It's a thorough treatment, top to bottom, it sounds like, much more so than the bait station.
That is correct.
How do they find you, Cajun Mike?
They can find me at 251-850-PEST or e3pest.com.
e3pest.com.
This is David Steele, Managing Partner of Monroe Meat Company in Beatrice, Alabama. We stay busy making sausage, processing deer, calling on customers, trying to sell the best sausage and bacon that can be found. But when I have time to take a break, I'm listening to What's Working with Cam Marston. Now, back to the show.
What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, Culver House College of Business, University of Alabama, Here is Scott's contact info one more time. ArdentGroup.com, A-R-D-E-N-T, group.com. Phone is 314-283-1589. Thank you, Scott, for your content and your deliberate processes that you gave us, steps 1 through 5. I really appreciate that. Folks, if there's somebody that needs to hear what Scott has to say, go to whatsworkingcam.com. You can hear the show again and forward it on to your friends. Going to have to wrap it up quickly today. We spent a little bit some more time than I had thought, but it was good, good stuff. I let it go. So find me on social media, Cam Marston. You can learn more about the show, where you can suggest guests. The show is produced by John Thompson with Ion Digital. Have a good week, everybody.